Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Katie Balls. On this week's episode, we're talking about riot chic, the problem of electric cars, and how women's sport has won our hearts. First, is rioting becoming fashionable? That's what Cosmo Landesman asks in the week after Dalston was rocked by unrest. He believes that the middle classes are swarming to these disturbances to express some apolitical anger. So is he right? Cosmo joins me now along with Tom Gash, author of Criminal, the truth about why people do bad things. So, Cosmo, in your piece this week, you say rage is now all the rage. What happened last weekend to get you thinking about rioters, riots? Who was the kid you were speaking to?
Well, this is an old friend of mine. His son was in his 20s. We were talking, I was talking about this wonderful festival I'd been to, and I was sort of making conversation. I said, well, have you been to anything exciting lately? And he said, yeah, I went to this riot. And I asked him what that was, and it was the Rahsaan Charles riot that had happened. And what struck me as odd is the way he talked about it. You know, he talked about the excitement, the buzz, and the solidarity of everybody coming together, as though he'd been to Glastonbury or to a great rock concert. And that started me thinking is that many of the demos that we see today that become riots, they become riots because they're not really about politics so much. They're about a kind of collective group therapy where people get to express their anger. Anger becomes the central force in this kind of, in this world, as opposed to argument. That was the sort of kernel of the idea.
Yeah, so with protests, we often see SWP placards pop up at every protest. But what is riot chic? Is it a small middle-class phenomenon? Who are the people who are attracted to this?
Well, it's a lot of middle-class people who, young middle-class people, who see in joining forces with groups like Black Lives Matter and whatever, or getting involved in things, is a kind of more authentic idea of politics. They buy into the idea that democracy has failed, that there are no longer the legitimate avenues by which protest established, by which you change society, have all collapsed. It is part of this kind of nihilistic view of politics that a lot of people, more than just SWP people, buy into now. And the only way you can do it is to go out on the streets. It's not about the battle of ideas. It's about the battle of the police. This creates momentum. This gets a buzz on social media, and that becomes the event. It's the spectacle more than the actual substance. I see what's happening.
Now, Tom, you've written on why people commit crimes. Do you think there is a genuine phenomenon here of more kind of middle-class people doing this, taking to the streets?
I mean, I can't see it myself, to be honest. What I see is I see legitimate protests that are being used as an excuse or cover for a very small minority of people who want to cause trouble. And that's always been the case, really, actually. If you think about the poll tax riots, if you think about all of the disorder in the 1980s that was actually around genuine fascism, anti-fascism movements, there's always been this sort of both a hard fringe within the groups, but also just sort of people who aren't really interested in the politics at all who will cause troubles around them. I think what's interesting about Cosmo's piece, though, is that he is touching on something, which is that the backdrop of politics today in Britain, I think, provides more cover for people who do want to make trouble. In a sense, the reawakening of the political left and the hard left is a new phenomenon, and it creates this sort of much more volatile political backdrop where there are much more extreme opinions. There's a bigger difference between right and left.
There's a kind of, you can see this anger that I'm talking about that spills over the street. I mean, the obvious example is what's going on in social media and the whole trolling phenomenon where you attack other people. I think political discourse in the last 10 years has gotten really nasty. We don't just debate ideas, we exchange insults. We're out to get the other person. And I think this is why I think this riot chic fits into the mood of our angry mood that we're going through at the moment so well.
And there's something about the police. So I think it's really important to recognise how common it's been for the police and protests at police behaviour, sometimes without any justification, sometimes with a degree of justification, about the way in which certain communities are being policed. And the police become the focal point for protest. They become the representatives of the establishment that people are protesting against. But there are some genuine issues and really important questions, I think, today about how the police are going to develop relationships with communities that have more trust and confidence in them. Weirdly, looking at the statistics recently, you see that confidence and trust in policing is actually high. It's been rising slightly. It's in the Met. It's higher than it's been for quite some time. And I think that's related to the outpouring of public support following the terrorist incidents. But I think these are two separate things going on here, and different groups who are expressing their confidence or lack of confidence in, and trust in the police. And I think there's a certain communities where that trust just isn't there still.
The police are too easy a target. That's a problem. I don't think the real issue, if you're talking about Black Lives Matter, you know, there's a lot of black on black crime. And the majority of people that died through knife culture, as it's called, in London was all black people last year. This never becomes part of the discourse because it's very inconvenient. We could say the problem, the threat to young black people are the police, as opposed to, you know, there are wider issues here that don't ever get discussed. Is that fair to say?
I think, again, probably not. I mean, I think the way that lots of black people would have expressed it to me would be that the concerns about policing are much more around things like stop and search, perceptions that you're being targeted when you're not doing anything wrong. And then there are concerns which literally we need public inquiries to dig into about whether there has been police malpractice around the process of arrest. And there are still debates in certain communities. So certain people who are involved in the protests in Dalston do not believe the police narrative that Rashan Charles effectively died largely as a consequence of trying to swallow drugs that he was hiding from the police. That was the implication of the police statements at the time. The family didn't buy it. The large parts of the community didn't buy it. Now, the truth is, we don't know. We can either choose to trust the police narrative or we can choose to trust the skepticism of those communities. And people will do that based on their judgments.
But people don't, that's my point, is that people don't want to know. I mean, it takes too long. People want an instant judgment. That's the part of this mindset of Raj Sheikh is, let's don't wait until we know the facts. Let's condemn straight away because we need to get the emotion and the anger out. So that's what happens.
There's going to be a bit of that. But then
there's a considerable
The interesting question is, actually, does the fact that they're protesting out peacefully outside the police station actually ensure that there is a more effective and more thorough inquiry than there would have been otherwise? And I think that's a really interesting question to ask, and I don't know the answer to it. Does it help them to get legitimate responses to their grievances, or does it actually undermine the case? Does it actually increase the distance between police, mean that the police are going to be more likely to close ranks and not question their routine practices and processes?
I mean, there's peaceful protest, of course, but there's also when it crosses a line, as we did see partly in these kind of Dalston riots. Tom, do you think the fact that people don't feel they're being listened to by the police on this issue means that we're shaping up in a way for a perfect storm this summer? We're going to see more riots. We know that Notting Hill Carnival's coming up. Do you think we're going to see a lot more of this?
So a lot of people I'm speaking to in police and around policing are very concerned about this summer. Funny enough, sometimes stupid things like the weather will matter. I did a little piece of work, which I haven't published yet, around the patterns of rioting, and you find that warm sunny days and after warm sunny days, you do tend to get more people out, more potential for trouble to start. But I know that people are concerned both because they think that the political backdrop is quite volatile and because they're actually less confident than they were in the police capacity to respond given falls in officer numbers. Now, I don't know how serious those concerns are, and I don't know how stretched the Met really is on these sorts of things, but I suspect that there are issues outside London and that the real issues will arise if other cities where police force numbers are even more stretched than they are in the Met experience widespread disorder.
Cosmo, moving back to riot tourists. So on our American podcast recently, we had the Rolling Stone writer John Neffels say that young middle-class college-educated Americans now see protest as the new brunch. Do you think our Brits are once again taking an American concept and, you know, bringing it over here? Is that what we're kind of seeing? It's not quite brunch. It's more of an aggressive breakfast.
We've imported a lot from America and American culture, young British people have. But I don't think this particular, you know, there's a long history of this idea of riots as a kind of part of self-identity and, you know, group confirmation. You go back to the famous Clash song of 1977, I Want a Riot. I Want a Riot of My Own, where white youth were saying, hey, we want our riots too. We don't want to be left out on it. So I don't think we can say we got this one from America. We've done very nicely without them.
Well, there's something interesting about this US-UK transfer, both in terms of the patterns of crime and rioting and other social phenomenon, and in terms of the actual policing practices and response, which I think is really going to be interesting, because the big debate in the UK at the moment in policing that I think is still brewing is, do we want a police service that is more armed, has more equipment, more kit, and are we going to go in that direction, or do we want one that focuses on more engagement with the community, and how far are those two things mutually exclusive? Can you actually do both? I mean, does it matter if you're carrying a taser around when it comes to having a conversation with somebody to understand their issues and understand the problems that they have in their community?
And with the people who are kind of hopping onto this, you know, because they're joining the bandwagon, is one of the things that you think encourages them the fact that there doesn't really seem to be a direct threat against them joining a riot? The police are somewhat impotent here. What are they going to do to them?
It's interesting, right? So in 2011, I was weirdly playing basketball in Hackney, and in the changing rooms after the game, it was during the 2011 riots, so it was day two or day three, and there was an active conversation about people about, did you join in with the riots? You know, they were talking about using BlackBerry Messenger, BBM, and finding out where stuff was happening. And their motivations were really about joining in and grabbing some trainers, which is a stereotypical and really crude way of looking at the riot, and it does neglect any of the initial protests about Duggan, but I think truthful, right? I mean, in that that's actually what people were hopping onto, and they were hopping onto it because they were people who might do that anyway, and it just, there was a sense of a bit of euphoria and a bit of opportunity. So the riots all took place where there were plenty of retail outlets, where there were young people knocking around. I think what it means is that people joining in parts of these Dalston riots would have been that sort of group and that sort of demographic. There was a police response, and it seems to have quietened down rioting for, you know, 5 years or so, and there were punishments, and people got some very exemplary sentences for these offences. I don't necessarily think that that's been the reason we've had a delay before this riot.
But there's another problem here. It's not just in terms of police being armed or their tactics or being underfunded. What we have here is a moral deficit. We don't have the kind of moral arguments that prohibits, that sees riots as unacceptable. Even sort of Labour leftish people who came out and said, well, violence is, you know, not the answer. No one actually really came out and said, it's wrong. There's a moral case against this sort of action, because people, and it's kind of phony. People always say, oh, this is not the answer, this is not the solution, whatever. But when they don't condemn it, they're in a way saying, well, it's kind of something, because people are angry. People feel hurt. People feel alienated. Therefore, it's okay to express your feelings, even though we don't like the fact that you express your feelings in this way.
Well, this is where you really need to make the distinction between the protest, the peaceful protest, and the riot. And the people doing
both. Division. It's not always such a clear division.
I mean, broadly speaking,
because a lot of people who don't partake in the violence actually will accept that line of argument.
But then, Cosmo, I mean, finally, if we go with that argument, let's go back to your family friend who went to this riot and seemed to have a great time, cheaper than Glastonbury, even though Roshan Charles' family said they didn't want this. What would your message be to someone like that if they're thinking about doing this again?
Listen to the Roshan Charles family. I would say I have nothing to do with this. I mean, by all means, I'm all for peaceful process. That's why we've got to make the argument against the expression of anger and violence, because it inhibits other people. It undermines your democratic right to protest.
That was Cosmo Landesman and Tom Gash.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
Next, the government has just announced that by 2040, gas-guzzling cars must be off the roads and replaced by their eco-friendly electric siblings. In the magazine this week, Ross Clark despairs for the state of the electric car industry, which is dogged by battery range issues. He joins me now, along with noted electric car driver Isabel Hardman. So, Ross, in this week's magazine, you cast some suspicion on the government's target to ban petrol diesel cars by 2040. Why is that?
There's nothing wrong with having an aspiration to move to electric cars. I think that would be a thoroughly good idea. But the trouble is, when an aspiration becomes a pre-announced ban, which is what the government has done. In its manifesto, the Conservatives merely said we would like to phase out petrol-diesel cars by 2050. Last week, it suddenly became a pre-announced ban on all sales of new petrol and diesel cars from 2040. Now, that really relies on technology advancing to a stage which we're not yet sure whether it can advance to, because while we have electric cars at the moment, there's two fundamental problems with them. One is the cost of the battery, which in a, for example, in a Nissan Leaf, the world's best-selling electric car, the battery pack will cost you £5,000. The whole car itself costs, without the government grant taking it into account, £26,500. The Nissan Micra, which is the nearest equivalent, will cost you £11,000. There's this huge difference in cost. Now, I think that will come down. I think the battery technology, the cost of batteries will come down. But the bigger problem, which I'm more worried about, is range. And at the moment, if you have a Nissan Leaf, you will be told it will do 124 miles between charges. Then you have to plug it in. If you've got a rapid charging point, it's minimum of 4 hours. A normal socket, it's 12 hours. And then you can drive another 124 miles, in theory. But in practice, it's less than that. When the magazine What Car test drove a Nissan Leaf, they could only get 70 to 80 miles out of it. And that's when the batteries are new. Over time, the ability of a battery to store charge, as you no doubt know from your mobile phone, your laptop, it decreases. So people who've had Nissan Leafs for a few years are reporting they can't go more than like 30 to 35 miles. And once you get down to that level, it's okay for a kind of transport just around town, but it does not do the job of a normal car. I mean, about three or four times a year in my very antisocial Citroen diesel estate, I drive up to Scotland. It's 400 miles, takes me 8 hours from driving time. I mean, if I had to plug in the car for 10 hours every 70 miles, it's going to take me quite a long time to get there.
Now, Isabel, you are a proud owner of a Nissan Leaf. You're also currently in Scotland. Have you got anything to say in your car's defence, in your car's honour?
Well, I do love driving my car. It's a wonderful drive. It's very simple. It's also an automatic, which is quite nice as well. But the practicalities that Ross raises are an issue. I don't particularly mind some of the extra organisation, but you do need to plan your journey, particularly if you're spending a lot of time in somewhere like Cumbria, for instance, where I live part of the time. There's one charging point in another town to where I live. Now, I charge my car overnight at the back of my house, but if I'm doing a long drive, I need to work out where the nearest charging point is, and that involves logging into a map and finding it. If you're on the motorway, there are charging points at every single service station, and they do actually, you do a rapid charge, which takes half an hour, 45 minutes, and that does add about 70 miles to your range again, which is good. And in a way, it's quite nice stopping and having a proper break and having a little rest. But it does, as Ross says, it adds on a lot to your journey. And if you have charging problems, which is the real beef I have with these electric cars, that sometimes the chargers at service stations don't work, or they appear to be working, and you go off and you come back and it hasn't charged, then that makes your journey very stressful. Indeed, I nearly missed a children's drama performance a few months ago because it took us 7 hours to get from South Cumbria to Edinburgh, and that was certainly not how long we'd planned for it to take. So there's a lot that needs sorting out. Another thing that I find very frustrating about the charging network is that all of the chargers are slightly different. So firstly, you have to work out how to plug the darn things in, and secondly, you have to log into another app. And I think one of the most frustrating things about modern life is just constantly logging in and trying to remember your password for various different things. Now, I've got about four or five different apps on my phone just to charge my car, which just seems ridiculous. And again, is the kind of thing that if you're a sort of awful, smug, middle-class person like me who also has a folding bike and gets a veg box delivery, then maybe you think this is quite funny. But I can imagine most people thinking, oh, my life's complicated enough, thanks very much. I'm going to stick to petrol for as long as possible.
So, Ross, why do you think Gove has come up with such a, you know, stringent target? Do you think the Tories are just trying to seem environmental without really thinking it through? Or are they going to take the actions?
That's quite possible. But there's one other thing that fascinates me is, if you remember last October, Nissan announced, to some surprise, that it was going to build a new car in Sunderland. There was some kind of deal done with the government. Nobody was quite sure what it was, but Greg Clark, the business secretary, denied there was any money changed hands. Well, you know, Was this part of that deal? Was a pre-announced ban on petrol and diesel cars part of the deal? Because Nissan has a commercial advantage in electric cars because it's invested £5 billion in the Leaf, the first mass manufacturer, volume manufacturer to build a mass market car. It wouldn't surprise me as if, you know, this pre-announced ban for 2040 was part of the deal that persuaded Nissan to stay in Britain post-Brexit.
And we've also had the news that the electric Mini is coming to Britain.
Yeah, well, that's another. Was that part of a similar deal?
Electric-friendly. Isabel, do you think it would be good if they fix these snags, if they make more charging points? Do you think it is a good goal that the government have come up with when it comes to more electric cars?
Yes, I do, actually. I mean, they are big practicalities. We haven't really talked very much about the surge in demand for electricity that will be caused by people plugging in their cars when they get home as well, which is something that the AA has warned that the National Grid might not be able to cope with. But I do think, I mean, one of the reasons that I got this electric car was I am quite worried about air pollution. Having moved to London for the first time in the past year, I've been really shocked by how filthy the air is in the capital. I cycle around, I do a lot of running, and it's just gross, actually. It's a sort of toxic soup. And there are often reports that the air outside schools, for instance, is breaching unacceptable levels. The government has been in and out of court over the past few years over its inability to stay within clean air limits. And I think this is one of the ways in which we can try to clean up the air, particularly in urban areas. I think as far as I understand, some of the statistics on deaths related to air pollution are slightly misleading, but it is a health risk. It's not good for children. And I have noticed, I have to say, that I've had a lot more cold since I've moved to London, just because the air is dirtier than it is outside.
So, Ross, do you think this is a pressing problem the government is right to focus on?
Well, the government lost a court case against air pollution, so it's got to do, it's obliged to do something to cut pollution. I think in the short term, the hybrid, the middle way, if you like, is probably the way things are going to go, where you have a car which can run in electric mode or it can run with a petrol engine and can charge up while it's driving along in petrol mode. That's fine if you're in a rural area, then you get area. If you get to a town, you might be obliged then to switch into electric mode. I think if we go down that route, that would be practical. I can see that would be practical to do that within a few years. But to go all electric in the next 23 years, I think is pushing it, because the technology has not come along as fast as Austin Morris in those days did a prototype electric Mini in 1966, by the way, the year I was born. They've been at it for that long, but you know, these technological problems have not been solved in 50 years. There's no guarantee they're going to be solved in 23 years.
Yeah, you mentioned that in your piece, and in it you say that at the time they said in the next few years. It was back in 1967.
Yeah, there's a wonderful British Pathé newsreel. You know, it's all in clip tones, and they're driving along here now in our electric car. You know, in a few years' time, we could have millions of these on the road. And of course, you know, we didn't. And it's taken 50 years to get to where we are now. You know, I think there's a very question mark about whether this pre-announced ban can be effected without causing mayhem, bringing the country to halt.
So you're sticking with your diesel car for now?
Well, I shall have my diesel car for another 3 years. I won't buy another one, but I suspect in 3 years' time, I would hope that I might be able to buy a hybrid and I might be able to cut pollution that way. But of course, if you have an electric car, it's only green so long as the electricity that's powering it was ultimately generated by renewable means. And you know, there again, there's no guarantee that we can in the next 23 years increase the share of renewables, which at the moment is only 9%, and that includes really dirty stuff like burning wood pellets. There's no guarantee that we can get that up to, you know, we can be generating majority of electricity by renewable means by 2040.
And finally, Isabel, you are an owner of an electric car now. What would your advice be to anyone considering taking the plunge?
Oh, gosh. I think if you're someone who gets easily stressed out by logistics, well, my Nissan Leaf's lovely. It wasn't cheap, but apparently if you spend even more money, then you can get a car that goes even further, according to lots of men who got very angry with me on Twitter this week when I had the temerity to suggest that electric cars weren't necessarily that practical for that many people. So if you've got oodles of cash, you can buy something called a Tesla, which is even posher, which apparently takes you for miles and miles and miles and miles before needing a charge. But I mean, it's not cheap. It's not an option for most people at the moment. And it's also probably not an option for sensible people either.
That was Ross Clark and Isabel Hardman. Why wait for tomorrow's papers? The best analysis of the day's news is already on Coffee House. To subscribe to the Evening Blend email in order to receive the best of The Spectator each day, just head to spectator.co.uk/blend.
Finally, England's women's football team are currently destroying the competition at the European Championships in the Netherlands. They are the top-ranked team left in the tournament, a far cry from times gone by, where the country couldn't get behind the female counterparts to overpaid, over-laureled men. Simon Barnes' Champions Lioness is in the magazine, and to discuss the subject, I'm joined by a sports columnist, Roger Alton, and football writer Carrie Dunn from the Netherlands. So, in the Daily Mail this week, Dominic Lawson writes that the increased coverage of women's sport owes very little to objective assessment of sporting quality and excitement. Roger, what do you make of that comment?
I think sort of Dominic's a slight minority here. I mean, he's erected a false premise, which is that there's an enormous amount of coverage of women's sport. Actually, there isn't. He was coming after the England women, the Lionesses, had won their quarterfinal. And that was 2/3 of a page in the Daily Mail out of, you know, 20 sports pages, and about the same in most of the other papers. So it's covered, but the idea that it's exhaustively covered seems to me wrong. I think there is a slight problem with the broadcasters, particularly the BBC, because it hasn't really got any sport apart from women's sport. Sort of going on too much about how there's something you must see, this wonderful women's game, and they're slightly sort of overhyping it because it's their only property. But Channel 4, that game, that England-France game, was on Channel 4, and it had easily the highest audience of Channel 4 that night. It had 3.5 million viewers, fantastic number of people, because it was on terrestrial and way miles more than a lot of Premiership football matches get on Sky, miles more.
Carrie, you're in the Netherlands at the moment following the progress of the England ladies at the Euros. Are you feeling that national interest?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've had a lot of emails, a lot of tweets, a lot of phone calls over the past kind of fortnight to people who are kind of watching for the first time. But I think the interest seems to be kind of different this time. I mean, when I was in Canada covering the 2015 Women's World Cup, you know, people were kind of interested, but the time difference had a bit of an impact. So, you know, matches were kicking off at midnight, so people weren't watching. I think having it in Europe, obviously, with it, things being on at prime time, people can actually watch it. It's during the school holidays. People are getting really, really involved. And it sounds like it's a really exciting reaction to women's international football.
Do you think that we might now see, given the increased interest, a move towards more equal pay in football? We have that slightly in tennis now.
I mean, I was looking at Casey Stoney, who was the last England captain, has paid $25,000, last woman's captain. The last man's captain, Wayne Rooney, has paid $13 million. So there is a bit of a difference before the pay gap catches
gender
up.
Pay gap gender worse pay than gap. The BBC.
Even worse than the BBC, which is saying something. Carrie, can I ask you one other question? I watched some of that match on Sunday night and I thought it was really good. I mean, really good football.
Yeah, very professional football.
I know, no, I know. That sounds such a ridiculous thing to say. I'm going to shoot myself. But it was it was actually much, much better than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, I knew what you were saying. Yeah, I think people kind of have this kind of old-fashioned view, I think, of not just women's football, women's sport in general. Yeah. I mean, you know, these women are professional footballers. This is what they do for a living
sure.
now. And I think one of the things that really, really bugs me about, you know, like the Dominic Lawson column that you mentioned, and talking about kind of the quality of play and that kind of thing, and that's what determines coverage. No, it isn't. It never has been. The England cricket team, the men's team, were terrible for years, and they still got coverage. They still, you know, were on television. It's not about the quality of sport. It's about all sorts of things. It's about covering a national team. It's about how far they get in a tournament. It's about the story of the match or the story of the tournament. There's all sorts of things that feed into coverage, and it isn't, and it never has been, about the quality of the play, even though, as you say, you know, the women's football at the top level is excellent now.
And the competition. So, for example, Mike Atherton, the great England cricketer, described that Cricket World Cup final when England beat India at the death, with India collapsing. He described it as one of the best matches he's ever seen. And it was absolutely thrilling, that England World Cup final when the England women won at the death. It was fantastic.
Absolutely, and it's absolutely thrilling to watch. I mean, I watched the first innings of that Cricket World Cup final, and then I had to go to the England match against Spain in Breda. And so I was watching it on my phone and waiting for the last wickets to fall. And it was thrilling, even watching it by text commentary. So, yeah, fantastic.
And Carrie, I mean, on the subject of women's football and women's sport in general, obviously we're saying it should get more coverage and it deserves that, but attendance is lower at these sporting events than obviously with men's. Is that kind of, you know, a chicken egg scenario here? What do we need to be doing to change that?
Yeah, it is a bit of a chicken and egg thing. But attendances at domestic games in England are rising. I mean, it's a slow and steady growth, and that's always been the plan. I mean, obviously, women's football at the top level in England is still relatively small. Obviously, the league is smaller, so it needs to have a kind of a steady plan for growth rather than kind of just throw money at it and hope that will sort everything out. So I think kind of growing the attendances slowly, growing media interest as we go, it's kind of goes hand in hand. There's a synergy to it. But I'm really hoping that after these Euros, when the domestic season starts up next month, attendances will rise concurrently.
But, I mean, the England Cricket Women's World Cup final 4 years ago was in Calcutta, had an audience of 500. This year it was at Lord's, 26,000 people, packed.
So we're getting there. We've touched on Dominic Lawson, but let's revisit one other man's maybe slightly dinosaur views. John McEnroe recently got into hot water for saying that Serena Williams would lose to the men's world number 600.
700.
Oh, even more of a compliment. It's very nice of him. Was he right? Or is it not worth a comparison?
It's not even worth thinking about. It's a piece of rhetorical stuff. I mean, he admits Serena's an absolutely wonderful player. Serena would say that. But I don't know who the world's 700th is. He's a player you will have heard of, or 701th. She might lose. It doesn't mean a thing. Serena is a titanic athlete, a wonderful person to watch, very funny, clever, beautiful woman. The fact she might lose to some unknown Brazilian who happens to be the world number 700th is neither here nor there. I mean, men's tennis is immensely big, muscular and strong. Well, so is Serena, but it is just a different game.
And finally, Carrie, tennis is one of the sports where it really does seem to be almost an equal level of interest between the male players and the female players. What do you think other sports can learn from that when it comes to trying to pique interest in the female side?
I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, one of the things that tennis has done wonderfully is that it focuses a lot on kind of individuals. It builds interest in those individuals. So with team sports, it's slightly different. But I think people are starting to get to know players and they're taking interest in kind of their progress. And I think that's something that the team sports can learn from. You know, put these people front and centre. They've got fantastic stories, they're articulate and they love their sport. So, you know, talk to them about it, find out about them, and then people will take an interest.
That was Roger Alton and Carrie Dunn. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including Holy Smoke, our religion podcast hosted by Damian Thompson and Christina Adoni. And if you enjoy the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on the podcast, as well as pieces by Jenny McCartney, Aidan Wilson, and Andrew Basevich. And we have a special offer for podcast listeners, 12 issues for £12, along with a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook, if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/podoffer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.